Welcome to episode 6 of the Bobbycast. Thank you very much. And as our studio guest, Charles Esten, musician, actor, and all-around happy guy. Let's welcome him in with our two people clapping. Yay! Oh,
hey. Thank you for that smattering.
By the way, after about 9 months ago, I don't call you Charles anymore. I call you Chip.
Yeah, well, that's what everybody calls me. I mean, when anybody watched Whose Line, it was always Chip. And everybody
it Chip on Whose Line?
Yeah, on the show they said, hey, Chip this, Chip that. And in fact, they use that on the screen. But every other time you ever see me, my credit is Charles. But everybody's calling me Chip. People think I somehow moved to Nashville and I'm Charles now. It was never that. It wasn't.
This is Mike, by the way, our producer.
Hey, Mike. And I'm Charles. Call me Charles.
Sorry you had to walk through the war zone to get here. The flood has caused this place to be a disaster.
No, it was very interesting. It was like back this alley up through there and down through there. It felt very magical when I finally arrived.
Yes, it's like you've walked through the deep, dark woods, then finally it opens up.
Exactly, yes.
So let's start with today, and then I want to make a full circle back all the way around to today.
All right.
Okay, so let's start with today, because now I think it's interesting what you're doing. And so you're doing something now every single Friday, which means you put out a song every single Friday. It's like a single every single Friday.
Yeah.
Now, so talk about that for a second. So you decided, why did you want to do this?
Well, you know, I get to be on the show and I get to play a singer-songwriter.
Nashville, by the
way. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what brought me here. But I was a singer-songwriter long before I ever came here, long before I was an actor either. And certainly the show gets to where you can meet a whole lot of people, and I've been able to write with a whole lot of people and perform with a whole lot of people. So over these last 4 years, I've been not only writing music, but actually recording it, and ended up with a whole bunch of music that when I would go out to play shows, I would play a show full of songs that nobody had ever heard. And then when I was done, nobody could even go buy it, or if they liked it, there was nothing they could really do. And so I'd always meant to put out an EP or an album because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And finally, I don't know what was holding me up. It was the very fact that I wasn't doing that. That was telling me something was wrong with that. That was rubbing against me in the wrong way. Certainly some of it is that it's not like there were all these labels, you know, whining and dining me or calling me or anything like that. That's just the nature of it. I have this following and these people that love the show Nashville and love and come see my shows. But I didn't have that. And so it was like, well, how am I going to do this? And I don't know what made me think of it, but when I finally did, it was just like an aha moment of, yeah, the only reason I wouldn't do this is because nobody does it. And that's not a good enough reason, because what I really, really want is all these songs that I really love and I love getting to go play, I just want them out there. I mean, if anything comes of it, that would be fantastic, but I'm not really chasing that per se. When I say fantastic, I mean it would be unbelievably fantastic because I just wanted to get heard. And for now, I know very well what the mistakes are about this. I know how you're stepping on your own single every single week and how long it takes for one to go. But this is really just inspiring for me. It makes me want to write. It makes me want to record. If I can do this for a while, if I could do it in some insane way for a year and somehow...
You want to put out a song every week for a year?
If I could. I'm not going to go, oh, I need a song. Oh, this one sucks, but I need one. I'm not going to do that. You might think it sucks, but I'll never put out one that I think sucks. They're always going to mean something to me. And that's the other thing is that I'm all over the map. I don't know what that album would be. Everybody, I mean, it wouldn't be cohesive. There's no A&R department or no label saying this is the album and this song gets off it and this song gets on it.
Also don't think the albums are going to be a thing,
right?
In 5 years, like they're not going to be a thing because nobody cares,
right?
Frankly, nobody cares about records, and people do buy them because they have artists. And but you're seeing, for example, Florida Georgia Line put out a record this week, and I think it was number 2. Barbara Streisand beat it crazily. Like I was
right.
Listen, people don't understand how big Barbara Streisand is and was and has sold mm-hmm. over the years. Mm-hmm. So she's number 1. They're number 2. Britney's right there too. This album was like 60,000 less than the last album. And it's not because this album isn't any bigger or they're any smaller. It's because people aren't consuming it the same way. They're not buying whole products anymore. We want the songs, 1, 2, 3 songs maybe.
Yep.
Because we're not looking for the whole album anymore.
When I was growing up, it was always mixtapes. I mean, yeah, they had albums and we all had the albums. But then you would take your albums and you would make mixtapes with the exact songs you wanted on it, or even if it was the one artist. So I'm like, here's all these singles, go make your own albums out of my singles.
I do it on the radio. Like I would hit record, pause, play, and then Tone Loc would come on, and I would hit unpause, and then record Funky Cole Medina, and then I would wait for that to go off, and then I would do I Touch Myself by the Divinyls, and I would do that, and then I would do President. And that's what I have on me. It was the actual cassette tape.
I bet you still have those tapes, too. Probably, you're a pack, right? Yeah, somewhere there.
I do. I just put them all on a playlist now.
Do it.
So I'm going to play. This is This Town Is Ours. Tell me about this song here.
Well, this is actually a song I wrote with Chris Farron and Matthew West. Just wanted a song that says, I like songs. When you go play live, you probably notice yourself when you play live, it makes you realize what your set needs, what your show needs. Whether there's, I need some up tempo here. I just wanted a song to step out on stage and say, we're here, you know? And the first lines really speak to me. It's been a long time coming. It's been a hard road running. Now all that's done, and all we want to do is play.
Is it less than people search it as Charles or Chip Esty?
That's a very good point. You probably shouldn't have given me a long time ago. It's all under Charles because it's written, it's Charles. But
it's
if they search Chip Esty, I believe they do find it.
Here we go. This Town Is Ours. I'm gonna give you some of this. So that's been part of every single Friday.
Yeah, that's the most recent single. And I tell you, even listening to you play it, even listening to you play my single is a whole different ballgame than hearing you play something that Deacon sings on the air. Yeah, that's me performing it. But I think this is getting to the real root of it as I was hearing that, because you're like, oh, that's my baby. That's my child. Some people are going to like it. Some people aren't going to like it. And by the way, the cool thing about it is if you didn't like that, guess what? In like three more days, there's another single.
There's another.
so don't sweat it. But the cool thing about it is that even just having it out there is thrilling. I've been an actor for 25 years. So that means for 25 years, I go around saying what other people tell me to say, saying it in a way another guy or girl directs me to say it. Somebody else edits it up, produces it. They dress me. They want to dress me. I realized that it was tricky when coming here. It's like, who am I? What do I have to say? What is, you know what I mean? And that's what music does, is you're trying to speak from your heart. So I think I'm pinballing around to anything that comes through me right now. And I think after doing a whole bunch of this, I bet you that I know a whole lot more who I am and where my strengths are and what people are drawn to the most. And then maybe, you know, at some point I'll click into that a little bit more, but for right now it's all me.
So I can say from experience that, listen, Chip's a really nice guy. Like he's one of the few guys that he is as nice as he seems. We were walking through the airport, and we've been together on a few occasions doing different things. And when people call you Deacon, that's just, hey, it's great to see you. Thank you for – it's weird that people will be like, hey, Deacon, and you're like, that's me. How are you? Let's take a picture. And I was like, man, like a little bit – are you like, oh, man, I wish they would call me Chip. I wish they would know me as my – how does that work in your brain?
You know what's funny is I don't – it's interesting to me hearing you say that, because it doesn't even occur to me that I wish they called me Chip or they call me Charles. I don't care. It brought them joy. It brought them a connection. There's something about that character that means something to them. Maybe they share – they watch it with their mom every week, or maybe they share that, you know, there's something about the music. So – like I said, maybe it's that I've been doing this a long time. So there were people that knew me as Chip when I did Who's Line, and then there were people for a long time that just didn't know me. So I'm not gonna get in their face about how they know me. I'm just, you know, and it's all pure love. I mean, especially when you're walking down Broadway a little too late at night, you'll get a whole lot of Deacon. And that's all right. That's why we have season 5, Bobby. So I'm not gonna look that in the face and go, come on, man, my name's Charles,
you know? So let's talk about that for a second, because I want to go full circle and come back to the music. So Nashville is about to tape season 5, and it got pulled from ABC, and CMT and Hulu, I believe, are doing a deal together now with it. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, okay. It'll air for the first time on CMT, and then Hulu has it the very next day, I believe.
So was there a bit of time where you were really like, oh, I don't know if it's going to get picked up. Like, maybe I have to go and search for another job. Was that to you nerve-wracking because you had set your roots down here with your family?
Well, yeah, and you know, you were kind enough. You had me on in that interim gap where we were between what we had lost and what we might find, what we were sort of hoping to find. But again, I think this goes back to how long I've been doing it and how old I am, and how, and maybe it's just my basic faith has a lot to do with it as well. Before I got Nashville, I'd been doing it all for a long time, and I remember having a meeting with my agent, and I said, "Here's your problem with me as an actor." Is I'm too content. I have this unbelievable family that I just love being around. I get to do these good arcs on great shows, like whether it was The Office or Big Love or Enlightened, and you know, just on and on. I've been able to do these things that, where I was never the star, and I never really stepped above radar, but I was always that guy that people sort of knew. And so I literally said to him, "My problem is that your problem with me is that I'm content." I said, "Anything else more than I have right now would be gravy." And I literally said this, and I said, "But don't get me wrong, I love gravy. Gravy is amazing." So I said, and it was weird because once I said that, It was literally speaking it out and sort of letting go of the desperation to be that other thing. And I had a long time to let go. Sure, when I started out, I was going to be, you know, my wife worked with Kevin Costner, and I remember sitting across from Kevin and hanging out with him, and he could not have been kinder. But in my mind, I was young enough to go, yeah, I could be this. I got this. I could be the next that. And, you know, after a long time, you go, we're not. You know? And you understood, first of all, that very few people are that and are that anymore in the way we are. They don't have that. But what I'm getting back to is, so when I got Nashville, that was, you know, that's Southern gravy. That was everything I ever, literally everything I ever wanted in a show, because it put together the music, the writing, the guitar, acting with people like Connie Britton and Hayden, and just these unbelievable actors, written by Callie Curry. T-Bone Burnett my wife used to say, if you wrote down everything you ever wanted on a show, you would have missed like 80% of this. And she's right. So I get to do 4 seasons of it. Then when it goes away, I don't slip right back to desperation. Honestly, the first thing I slipped to was gratitude. I know it's probably a little boring, and you want like, oh my God. I went to gratitude first, because there was nothing I did out of desperation that got me Nashville. It was probably relaxing into it that got me Nashville. So I thought, man. And now the other thing I thought was, that's a shame. It's a real shame, because I knew we had new writers coming in, and I thought we had places to go, and I thought we had more songs to do. And then the very next thing that happened, the very next breath, almost the same breath, is that the Nashville fans started being heard. And then it was even more gratitude. It's like, damn, I don't know, man. It's one thing to lose your show and nobody says a word and it just sort of goes away. It's another thing to lose your show and there's this outcry and people are really upset and really organizing. I mean, that's the other thing. You know how fans now, they're not just into you. They're savvy. They know social media. They know getting organized to sign petitions and things. And still, if nothing had ever come of that, that's a hell of a way to go out with people that love your show and your character going nuts. And then there were people on the show that was like, oh yeah, we're getting picked up and by somebody. And I was never that guy. But when it happened, I was like, that's awesome. That's really awesome.
How did you get the role? And were you ever in, like, was that a spot where you're sitting? Because I was reading an article by John Krasinski, and he's talking about he went to New York and he was trying to make it forever, and he didn't make it. GQ did this great article about how he spent 3-4 years out there, and he told his mom, "Hey, I'm moving back," and she's like, "Wait a few more months." And he said he walked into this room, and there were like 11 guys that looked exactly like him trying for the role of Jim Halpert for The Office. And he was like, there's no way. And he said, as his time came up, they all went to lunch. And he's like, well, this is weird. So he sits there through lunch. They come back. One of the guys sits down. And he goes, hey, what do you think about this show? And he goes, well, to be honest with you, I just don't want to see an American version of the greatest show of all time run that show. And the guy ended up being like Jeff Daniels or whoever the producer, or the
Greg Daniels.
Excuse me, Jeff Daniels is So it was Greg Daniels. And he was like, I like your honesty. They auditioned and he got the role right before he quit. And so for me, I'm thinking, man, that's how these guys are auditioning. Can you talk about how you auditioned or they came to you for the role of Deacon?
Sure. First of all, by the way, do you ever go to YouTube and watch auditions?
I do sometimes.
Have you ever watched his?
Yes, I have.
He's so fully and completely Jim immediately. Yep. And you get to see the other guys do it too, and they're all fantastic. And that's my nightmare, is that my bad auditions are somewhere up there, out there. But they're all so great. But he's just so utterly Jim. I don't know. When I started out, I guess it was the fact I didn't have a plan B. There's nothing else that I thought I'd be great at. So I told you before, I had a desk job, and my boss utterly found me more than twice with my face on the desk and slobber.
What did you do as a desk job?
Oh, honestly, I sold advertising supplies for real estate companies. So like Coldwell Banker fly swatters and ERA shoehorns and Century 21.
So that wasn't your thing. That wasn't your thing.
No. In fact, I remember the guy told me that got me the job, I needed something to support me while I was first in LA. And he said, this is after I won a game show, by the way. I won a game show that got me to be able to be there for a year, but then I need to get an actual job. And he said, look, you got to, don't tell this guy you're an actor. He wants somebody who's really a salesman that wants to. So I had to go
and act like a salesman.
I had to act like I really wanted to sell, ERA keychains for the rest of my life. And this, I'd found my career. And then it was about 8 months later that I got my first talking bit on TV, and I was going to have to quit and go do this show. And that was when I got my first taste of people just love TV, man. Because that boss, I was like, I'm real sorry. I wasn't honest and upfront. And I said, I'm not going to lie again because it felt gross. I didn't like it. I was like, I should have told you I'm an actor and I'm going to have to. He's like, you're going to be on TV? Like he could have cared less that I was quitting. I was a lousy employee anyway, but he was just thrilled that I was going to be on TV. So anyway.
Show was that?
That was a thing a long time ago on a little cable channel called, it was Nickelodeon, so it was Nick at Night, and that was called On the Television, which was sort of like a Siskel and Ebert spoof, except it was TV shows that they would make a little mock TV show, like My Five Dads instead of My Two Dads, and I just had a few roles, small roles on it, and I got to write a little bit on it, and it was the first thing, but...
Let me bring you back to the Nashville audition.
Sure, please. So I was saying that I had been doing it for so long that I was always the guy. I remember what I was going to say. There was nothing else that I was going to do. I figured it was going to take 6 years. I don't know where I got that number, but I also knew that I'll just keep doing it as long as I can do it. So six turned into more. And then I was always working, but there was always sort of I definitely have a thing where I like to be liked. And when you're an actor, that can be a little brutal because it means you're always trying to be the good boy. And I can remember once it occurred to me that, do you know that you take a shower and brush your hair and get brand new clothes on for every single audition? And like I'm going on a job interview, even if it was, I could probably go play in a homeless guy that'd been in the streets for 3 weeks and I'd go take a shower and brush my teeth and get a haircut. And I was just always trying to be the best guy, and there's so little in acting that you can actually take care of that I was trying to take care of every variable I could. And it wasn't long before this, as I just told you in that other story, that I sort of relaxed into it, like just quit trying so much, quit caring so much. And I think that was real important for a role like Deacon, because there's nothing needy and all hepped up about Deacon. It's just sort of very, very chill guy that's seen it all, been there, done it. I don't think I could have gotten the role even 3 years earlier. I wouldn't have been able to sit back in it in the same way.
Were you the guy they had in mind originally, or were there a bunch of guys that you had?
Nobody had me in mind originally. It was thank goodness it was Callie Curry was casting with RJ Cutler was the other producer, and very strangely, Jeannie Bachrach was the casting director. Jeannie Bachrach's husband is one of my best friends in the world, David Burke. David and I went to college together. I did one play in college because I'm in a band. David and I did that play together, almost like a two-man thing. So all those years later, she's casting it. Now, to anybody out there, that sounds like, oh, he's in. You're not in. That's, I could have gotten into that audition. So Jeannie was very kind and supportive always of me. But you got to, once you're in, all the casting director does is get you in and support you along the way. You got to earn that from the producers. So I remember I knew who Callie Curry was. I read that script and I was like, oh, man. The inside head goes, I really want this. And you go, shut up, man. Just calm down. Be cool. And somehow that was the stronger voice. And I never went to, I really want this again. I just said, what occurred to me is I'd come so close on so many things, shows you've seen, movies you've heard of, and not gotten them, that I realized that, so what? I survived. Like when you do stand-up, they say you die on stage. Oh, I died
many
last
times.
Night.
I died many times during a great set.
Yeah, but that's the thing is, you don't really die. The next morning, you know, you're still eating breakfast, and you know, when you get kids, they're still telling you they need new shoes or something. So you don't die. And all those shows I didn't get, I was like, I'm fine, I'm still here. So you sort of let go in that way a little bit. And by the way, maybe letting go and maybe my lack of drive and my I'll take all the time I want is why it took me 20 damn years. It's very possible. I just don't have that muscle that some others have. But in any event, so when I know I'm going in there, yeah, they got other people in mind. They got names in mind.
Were you the only one there when you showed up?
Well, that's funny because I was, except as I showed up there in the waiting room was Hayden Panettiere. And there were no guys. There were no.
Obviously, she wasn't trying for the deacon role.
She was not. No, yes. No. Thank God, because she would have beat me out. Before I went in there, I thought, you know what? I've been doing this country music. I've been writing it. I've been playing it live. I've been doing writer's rounds. And I know that all these guys that beat me out all the time, the same guys, you know, that John was talking about, that you see those same guys again and again in the room, or if they weren't in the room, you'd see them later in the show. It's one of the hardest jobs in the world, because it's one thing to really want a job. If it's, say, there's in the real world, there's a job and you really want it, you do everything you can, you put your heart and your soul, you go and you do a meeting and you give your resume, and then you don't get it. All right, you move on. But what you don't have to do in the real world is watch somebody else go do it for 12 years and make $30 million doing
right.
it. And so I had, anyway, gotten around that, and I thought, you know what, I might have a chance at this one, because all those guys I know, not everybody can play guitar.
Did you take your guitar with you?
Oh, yeah, they told us to. They said, and I was thrilled by that. I was like, oh, man, they're not going to pretend that these people are musicians and singers. That's why I might have a shot at this one. And so there are a couple things real quickly. This is a small piece of the story, but I had just recently found a really cool little stand for my guitar, folded up into nothing. You know, sometimes guitar stands are big, unwieldy things. So I'm walking out the door and I go, I might as well bring my cool new stand. And I go to this audition and I walk into the building. And this happens again and again in my career, where things that are meant to be have meant to be written all over them, and the little hints from God that this might be the thing. And one of those was the very place I went to audition with Callie and RJ and Jeannie was the same building and the same hallway where I had shot Whose Line Is It Anyway for a couple of years. And I knew that place way more
than
that.
Did it feel comfortable to you just because you were there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of ownership. I mean, years ago, I auditioned to play Buddy Holly, and it ended up that I got to audition for Buddy in the very same theater where I was the house manager. I swept up, I tore tickets, I made coffee. And so it was like auditioning in my living room, and this had a little bit of that. So I walk into that building already with that little lift in your step, like, all right, this, not everybody has this wind behind them. And then I walk in, and there's Hayden Panettiere, and that's the cheerleader, save the cheerleader, save the world. And I know who she is. She doesn't have a clue who I am. And we said hello. I said, nice to meet you. Shook her hand, and we all both went back to our notes. They were seeing me first. She was just doing something before she went in. So I went in, and they were very, very warm and welcoming, and there was two songs. And then first I did a couple scenes, and then I was going to do two songs. I completely forget the order I did them in. I played an original. I played a Blake Shelton song, actually, which was What I Wouldn't Give, which is one I really liked and I thought was right for Deacon and Raina.
Did you know Raina was going to be Connie at the time?
In the first audition, I don't think so. It's hard.
So you
for
just
me
had
know.
A character in your mind that you were singing to or about or with?
Yeah, absolutely. And it jumped off the page who that character was and who these two people were and the history they had. By the way, when you ask questions, I don't know. When I read your autobiography or when I read other people's autobiographies, I'm like, I would have no shot at writing that because I have the worst memory. So I would. How do you know all that?
Well, because
stuff?
You're going to get sued if it's not right. So you better freaking get it right.
No, I'm not saying I get it right. That's probably why no, I don't even start.
You'll start remembering once you decide. Well, I got to write a book, and I'm going to get sued if I'm not right.
I can see that. You're like it was kind of like no, I don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't think I did know at that point because that would have made me a little nervous for to be honest. So I sit down and I think what I did was I played the songs first. And then I remember I pulled out my little stand and I put my guitar in it and I went over to do the scenes. And I knew this guy. I knew this guy, Deacon. I don't know why. I just got him and I could sit back in him and it came very easy. And the thing that I know what I was talking about earlier, from this long career of not getting these things I wanted, sometimes there's roles that are so good that you might end up only getting to play this guy once. And that's at the audition. So what I would always say is, I'm going to do it my way. I get one shot to play this guy right now. In this moment, I'm the one playing Deacon. And this is how, and instead of what, you know, you're always talking about aiming for what they want instead of doing what you are going to be great at or what you want. I wouldn't know what they wanted Deacon to look like. There was a time that's all I'd try to guess at.
You didn't chase what you thought they wanted. You did what you felt was you.
Because honestly, you reach a certain point where I was like, you might think you want that. You're wrong. You want this.
You finish the audition. You play. You sing. You do your scene. How long until you actually know from that point that you have the role of Deacon?
Let me take a quick shortcut. As I'm walking out of the room, I don't know if I told you this before, but as I open the door, there's Hayden Panettiere by the door, like listening, like comedically, like I Love Lucy or something. I almost hit her in the head with the door, and I walk out, and she starts clapping and saying, because she heard me singing and she liked the songs, and I'm like, what in the world? I said, can you come to all my auditions? Because this is fantastic. And so I'm acting cool. And she, now we really meet. And I said, as I'm ready to leave, I'm just sort of blowing smoke. I go, well, I'll see you on the set. That's what I said to her. Totally. And I was nowhere near getting this job. And, you know, finally, when we were on the set one day, she said, see you on the set. And, I go home and I knew it went really well. Callie Curry is a very enthusiastic, heart on her sleeve person. And she also doesn't suffer fools gladly. She's very intelligent, and I could tell there was a connection towards what I was doing. I also know how far that I'm not a name. And so they generally, networks want to give shows to names, especially a bang on lead like this. I've been doing it long enough to know a bang on lead, and Deacon is exactly that. He gets to hurt. He gets to feel, he gets to fail. He gets to win. And that was all in the pilot. So I knew. So yeah, it took a while, and then I had to go in again, and then I had to go in another time. And not a lot of people know this, but at one point they made an offer to somebody. They called me up, my agent called me, well, they made an offer. And I was like, oh, you're kidding me. And I said, who? And the guy they said was somebody I knew personally and somebody I'd grown up with, actually, and had sort of not followed out to LA, but somebody where I was like, I know that guy. I know those guys. Maybe it's not just craziness. If he can do it, maybe I can do it.
So they offered the role to him, and he said no?
Well, I didn't know that the first day. And then the second day, I keep reading the trades. Right? And I thought, yeah, he'd be great. He'd be fantastic. And I was a little heartbroken. It was more than a little heartbroken. Finally, after a week, I'm going, what the hell? And my agent calls up and goes, your friend passed. What? And they go, they want to see you again. Even after that, it was another two auditions, including a screen test again for ABC. I'm telling you, my family, we would drive right by the ABC building in Burbank every day. I was taking my girls to soccer. And every single day, we'd drive by at least twice, there and back.
Like Bob Hope Drive?
But I was on the 134. Yeah, right. Well, Bob Hope Drive is NBC. It's right before that. It's right next to it. Yeah. And every single time we'd walk, drive by, the whole car would say, please, ABC. And I'm talking, we'd be in the middle of a discussion. We'd be going, I don't want to. Well, we had chicken last night. Let's get it. Please, ABC. Hamburgers. And then I waited and I waited. And finally, I ended up getting it. And real funny is a couple of weeks after I shot the pilot, I finally gave my friend a call and said, I didn't really know, you know, they don't make Hallmark cards for this situation, but thank you for passing on Deacon. And by the way, he had personal reasons. It wasn't that he didn't love the role. There was something he had other things. He's more ahead than I was. And he started laughing. He said, I was so glad when I heard you got it. It's just, you know, meant to be. And it still blows my mind.
I'm not going to ask you who it was, but would we know him if you said his name?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll leave it right there.
Thanks.
Okay. Let's back off in Nashville for a second. Go backward. So my two favorite shows are The British Office and The American Office. Those are my two favorite shows. Like, I love them both. I just love them. And so one of my top favorite episodes is you. You're in, like, whenever they go to the convention.
Yeah.
And working with those guys and working with Jim, because you were on The Office, working with Jim and Michael Scott, I'm calling their character's name.
Sure.
Steve Carell. John. All that. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about that. Like, you get such, your role was so funny as a straight guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they call and say, hey, we want you to do this role on The Office. You walk in, it's a single camera shoot. Had you been a part of a single camera shoot before where there's no laughter while doing a comedy?
I actually had, and let me back up. I'll say they didn't just call and offer me this thing. This is a very interesting story on how I got the office. And by the way, the office opened me up for a whole bunch of other things. If you went back and looked at my resume, you would see that the office was a point, was sort of a sea change. And the reason for that is because it was an industry show. It was beloved. It was intelligent. It was done right. So in a sense, when you get on a show like that, it vouches for you for other shows. It's a shortcut. They go, oh, there's the guy in the office. And they probably watched it too. So that gets you another level up. And that started opening up things on HBO. And all of those things were one of the reasons where they said, yeah, he can do the Nashville. So it all goes together. But the funny story of how I got that one, let me tell you, I was on a single camera comedy pilot that got, it got shot for NBC. And in that show, it was a complete cattle call for these two characters. And I got completely arbitrarily hooked up with Rainn Wilson.
Oh, really?
This is years before the
Office. Dwight Schrute, by the way.
Dwight Schrute, right. Years before the Office. Totally randomly, me and him. These two characters are androids who solve crimes in this pilot called The Expendables. It wasn't even a pilot then, it was a script. And they would just put you together, and we're reading the script back and forth, and we just started improvising and messing around and screwing around. And immediately I saw this guy was brilliant and hilarious and very kind. And so we just clicked, and we were having a ball with it. You know, it was so silly and goofy. And so we went in and we ended up getting it. And more than that, then we end up getting, now we're going to have the whole show is cast. Now we go to NBC and it's a big table read. And this is where they decide if they're going to even make a pilot of it. And we're sitting at this long corporate table, and he and I are just sitting next to each other, utterly riffing on these two idiot characters who are androids that solve crimes. And by the way, 80% of the show we were naked, and you know, just because we were androids and they were just strategically shot. So we end up, because it went so well, we were so loose and we're making each other laugh at that table read that ends up going to pilot. So we shoot a pilot for this thing, and it's such a tricky line to walk, and it ended up not really working. We didn't get picked up, but there's some very funny moments back and forth with he and I knew he was destined for great and big stuff. In any event, I get this audition. When I was a huge British Office fan myself.
The greatest show, oh, right?
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
Well, talk about sea change. I'd never seen anything like that. When anything could be allowed to be that quiet and that boring for that long and that uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable is the key.
Yep.
I mean, it's the most uncomfortably awesome show I've ever seen in my life.
It's cringy. You would even share it with some people. Like, you got to see this most amazing thing. And you'd sit there for a couple minutes and go, oh, they got it. They're going to have to get this on their own.
If they don't get it, then I look really stupid.
It's true. You look like an idiot. It's like, it's like, you got to see this video of paint drying. Hilariously. And they're just going, I just see paint drying. So anyway, I was a huge fan, and I saw it, and I was like, man, I can't even believe they're going to try that. I know a bunch of shows that they've done it this way. And then I saw Steve Carell was going to be the lead. And then I saw Rainn was the, and I was like, oh, I don't know. They might be able to do this. So immediately I saw the first two. I go, I think they got a shot at this. They're finding their own voice. I called my agent up. I go, you know, on the British one, there's the good boss, the guy that has his stuff together and everybody, you know, Michael wishes he was. I bet they end up doing that. When they do, you got to get me in there. And so they ended up doing that in season three, or the very end of season two, actually. And he got me in there, and I wanted to meet with them. And, I'm sitting there and go, so I hear you're a friend of Rain's, because Rainn must have said something nice that I was coming in. I somehow let him know, or maybe saw him as I walked in. And I said, yeah, not only that, Rainn and I were in a pilot together where we played androids that solved crimes. And they're just dying laughing. You are kidding. I said, and not only that, I have a DVD of that pilot. And they're like, no, you don't. And not only that, if you give me this job on the first day of shooting, I will show up and put that DVD into your hand. And I could just see all their eyes light up. And they called before I got to my car in the parking lot. And I'm certain that's how I got that. There was a lot of great guys in the town, but they wanted that DVD. So they got their DVD, and I got to play this character. And you're right, he was a straight man. And that was another real lesson, because that showed what it's like to be on something great. I had been on a lot of cool things, but this was really very, very special. And what it occurred to me was that just being on it, people thought I was funnier. Because if you look, I don't have that many jokes. I had to really work a lot harder at being funny on things that weren't half as good. So people would see you on and they go, oh my God, you're so funny.
But here's the thing though, when you say that, like I look at that and I disagree and go, your timing of not being funny was equally as funny. Because to me, humor is not just about saying something funny. It's also about sitting back and letting funny happen, and then hopping back in at a point, even if you're not funny, knowing when that point to hop back in was.
Yeah, I know what you're right. You're right. I was very funny.
You were. I thought it was amazing. Like, it's really one of my favorite episodes. I mean, and then Michael Scott ends up in his room by himself having the party.
Oh, that's one of my favorite lines is Jim and I do an inside joke. He goes, huh.
I always want to be a part of one of those.
Yeah, because I love inside jokes.
I'm such a fan of that show. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Did you crack a lot during that?
Well, you know what? I was actually pretty good at maintaining for the joke itself. But then when normally you would say cut because we're out of dialogue, you'd be a fool to cut on Steve or on John or any of them. So that's when they would try a couple other things. And those are the ones that sometimes you'd lose it a little bit. But look, I was uncool when I went to the office. I had been doing this a long time, but I wasn't cool enough to be cool. I was too much of a fan. It was like I'd won a damn radio contest to go be on a show that you love. I was doing my best to be good, but I have to admit, those are some cool kids to be hanging around. That's like at high school. And in retrospect, they're probably, he was a little bit, excited to be there. I bet they would, but they couldn't have been kinder. I spent, most of the time with John and with Ed Helms. And we had a great time. It was one of the hardest lines I've ever said in my life was when I'm offered the job to take over at, the Scranton branch. And I said, well, actually I've agreed to a job that I'll be taking at Staples. And I remember first reading that in my script, the line that basically kills you off the show. And I was like, what would happen if you just refused to say that? What if I just said, well, thank you very much. I accept your offer.
I do accept this position. Thank you. That's all I will say.
The producer would be like, oh, damn, he tricked us.
So let's go back for a second to Whose Line, because I watched Whose Line. And, I remember all of you guys, like Drew had hosted and Wayne. And, I mean, you could go through the whole cast. But I just didn't know how that was shot. Like, would you guys just go up and nail it every time, half hour? And
No. That's the thing is, the level of, first of all, it was, people always wonder, how could it be so good if it's improv?
It was perfect. I was like, you guys are improvising and you're nailing every sequence, every joke.
Yeah, so everybody would think with improv that it wasn't really improvised. They were always sure that we were given the topics.
Were you given the topics?
No, we were never given the topics. In fact, I contend that it would be way harder to act like you were thinking of something off the top of your head than to actually think of something off the top. And something else I'll say is, if you go back and look at the transcripts, that's not like something you would write. If you're going to, Greg always talks about somebody heard he was on an improv show and watched and said, why not prepare something funny? It was that guy's take. You can't really do that. Now, what the trick was that nobody really thought of was they just wouldn't air the crap. They wouldn't,
So you would tape for a long period of time for Whose Line?
Yeah, you would tape like maybe 3 hours, maybe 3.5 hours sometimes. I think it would be like that. I don't know, because you never came down. You would even stop during commercial breaks. They would put the commercial break in there. But while they were doing that, it wasn't like we were toweling down and just drinking water. We had to keep that audience going. So we'd keep giving each other crap or just, giving Drew a hard time, or the director would come out and Ryan would throw something at him. And
so it was like Colin. Who was on the show?
When I was on, I was one of the fourth chair guys. It was Wayne Brady and Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie. And then the fourth chair would rotate between a bunch of different, great people. And it was great to be on that. But that meant, I remember when I was on the British one, and then I wasn't on for a little bit.
Who hosted the British?
Clive Anderson, who's the British one. He goes, all right, it was just a little bit of a different ball game. In fact, it started off as extremely British. It was a radio show, Bobby. It started off in England as a radio show. So they would improvise just like we are, sitting at mics and create these things. And then they decided to make a TV show out of it. Still very British, and still in that more British way, was very cerebral and very verbal. So they would almost stand right where they were. That's why the stage was probably so small. And then you started hiring Americans like Ryan and Colin, who would look like a velociraptor walking across the stage. Or I remember Ryan once was just a baby deer being born. And that some of that way more physical stuff. And then the Americans, the British invasion came this way. The American invasion of Whose Line went that way. And then the whole show came here to the States. And when it came back to the States, it was not lost on me that here's these three guys that are on every week. and Drew. And these guys are my friends. Ryan was my biggest supporter. He told those producers all the time, you got to get Chip on. And that meant a lot to me. But I knew that when I got on the show, it wasn't just a matter of being funny. I'd seen other people as in that guest role. And I noticed that the ones that worked didn't defer, didn't act like a guest at the party. They acted like they belonged there as much as anybody. And the way to do that is to throw a few elbows and smack somebody else comedically in the face, because it's like walking into your house. I would defer a little bit, and I realized that didn't work there. So you just had to, the first job was to act like you belonged. And then once you act like you belong, now you're just improvising, and they want you to do that too, because it's just like tennis with people that are putting the ball right back on your racket, and they want you to put it right back at them very, very hard. So, it was just a matter of, first of all, they're the funniest guys I know in the
world. Would you feel, because I have peers, friends, very close friends, that I think are so much better than me at what I do, and we do the same thing. Like, one of my buddies has the biggest hip-hop show in the country. His name's Charlamagne. I have a friend named Kennedy who was on MTV. She does Fox News. She's one of my best friends. She's so smart. And we will go to dinners together. It's like our little group. Mm-hmm. It's our group. We talk all – we stay close. We confide. We go to advice. But I feel like they're so much brighter and quicker and funny that I just feel so much pressure. And I want to be as good as they are. At the same time, I just respect them so much. Did you feel that with those guys? Like, wow, these guys are so good. I've got to get to that level. Or did you just feel like I'm part of the group?
It was when I was in England that I felt I didn't know what the group was. And I didn't know how good they were when I first got it. So that was not an issue. And then when I was like, oh, man, they're bringing it. So I got to bring it. And then I did. And then I started seeing how good the people I was with were. And it made me think about it more. And when I started thinking about it, I got less good. And so I fell off for a while. But when I got back on, I didn't go to that place again. No, I have to admit. And the reason is in any given moment, what you don't have is you're rarely on stage with those peers of yours.
Right.
I would sit in four chairs. We'd all step to the end of the line, and they would tell a joke, and it would kill, and somebody else would do another joke. And then I would step forward, and every once in a while, I would get the biggest laugh. In any given moment, any of us can kill. And we would realize that on tour. We would tour with larger groups. Like 10 of us would go out in Las Vegas. Every Super Bowl, Drew would bring like 10 people to the MGM Grand. And at the beginning of the night, they would give all the applause. The last people out were the people that everybody knew the most. You would end with the biggest names. And the applause would gradually grow so that by the very end, the very people they knew the most got the most applause. What we always notice is at the end of the show, the applause was based on what kind of show you had. So it could totally change up. The first guy introduced might have just been on fire.
And he would get the biggest.
And people would go crazy at the end. And so we did know that on any given night, anybody can win the day. And honestly, it's funny. It's not, you would think it would be way more competitive. It's not. It's thrilling when somebody across from you says something hilarious.
And it's not competitive with my friends. It's like, man, I just want to be that good. Oh, I look at them and go, they are the, I don't know if I can ever be that good.
But aren't they completely good in different ways?
Yes, absolutely. And that's for some reason, they come to me too and go, hey, can you help me with this? And I'm just blown away that they're like, why do you need my help with something?
Well, the thing is with comedy and when this thing we're doing, and you guys too, you're different things in the stew. Like Ryan's a carrot and Colin's a potato. And I mean that literally for both of them. No, I'm only kidding. But so I would never say, how can I be more potato-y or how can I be more carrot-y? I know that I had a different role. And it's funny, once you start to understand what your role is, then you get to really be that thing. I mean, I forget who said, somebody famous said, learn what you are, then go be that. And we ended up getting to do that. And then they rely on who your character is. Drew, for example, would always know he was the guy that would be the butt of the joke. And he played that. That's not always an easy character to play, because you can act too hurt, and then the audience is like, oh, or just that. So everybody had their role, and they made me, honest to God, that's probably the real answer. Those friends of mine, they made me feel funny.
So I have a clip here of Hoedown from Who's Line. So what is it? Mike sent me up here.
That's just the music to it. That was my favorite bit on the show.
So what was Hoedown?
Hoedown, they start playing this, and you just had to make up a line. And if you went first, it was the hardest because you had no time, right? You had to just think of it quick.
And you were usually first, right?
I was first. Yeah. So it was tricky. Although sometimes I liked first the most because you
so
got...
So it was a song you had to continue on?
Yeah. Like it'd be going, I'm sitting here with Bobby. We're sitting in the chair. You know, and then make
Dude,
a background.
Here comes the woods. I see a hairy bear.
He's going to chase me now. He's going to be a blaster. And I can't run that fast, but Bobby can run faster or something. something like that. And they weren't all that good. The thing was you would get to gather your thoughts as quickly as you could. And the good thing about going first is when you went second, what would happen all the time is that person in first spot would steal your best rhyme, would steal your best joke. And so, God, people loved Hoedown. Those are some of my favorite things too. And it's funny, real quickly, no, you didn't even ask. One of the funny things that people that try music improv and something even like Hoedown is, they forget the concept of a punchline. So if you're doing a song about this podcast, the line is going to be the punchline would be podcast. All right, so or maybe it's, I'll make it Bobby Bones. But I'm not here alone. I'm sitting in my chair beside Bobby Bones and beside Bobby Bones. Right. So what people would do is they mess up. And what every amateur does is they go, I'm here with Bobby Bones, but that's okay. Cause I am not alone. And it's like, wait, that didn't pay off. That was the rhyme that you wanted to set up the thing, the feeling of resolution when you say the thing that clicks. You know, do you get what I mean?
No,
it's not.
I do.
It's not like your name's some huge punchline, right. But it's the more satisfying way to do it. Otherwise, you say the thing, and then anybody can come up with a thing that rhymes with Bobby Bones, and it doesn't really point to anything. So, there was one I did. Sometimes you would have to actually have a punchline itself in these jokes. I did one about Colin. It was about drinking, and I talked about his. His mother drank when she was pregnant. I'm sorry, that's the truth. When they took her blood was 80 proof. The doctors felt so bad they didn't know what to do. But if your baby looked like Colin, then you'd be drinking too. was you know, and it's not. That's the thing is, it's not the funniest joke in the world. But number one, it rhymed in the right order, and the punchline came at the end. And number two, they just watched you think of it. That's always the magic of it. And it is a little bit like magic that it seems like a magic trick, which is why sometimes it's even more exciting in person. I don't know if you've ever been to a live improv show, but you know how you watch magic on TV? There's always somewhere in the back of your head, oh, yeah, it's on TV.
It's on TV.
Yeah, but if you're just sitting angles. There, I mean, if you're sitting, somebody did a, I was over at Tin Roof the other night, and this guy came by doing card tricks, and he did that thing. I wrote my name on a card, and he put it in his wallet, and I was just like, if that had been on TV, I would have went, But it was right in front of me. So that's improvs like that. It freaks you out. I had friends that would come to the Groundlings Theater where I did it, and they just didn't believe it was improvised.
So you're a groundling.
Actually, I was not a groundling because I took all their classes. It was like you start with basic, intermediate, lab, advanced, did all that, got into the Sunday show. And the Sunday show would be like the JV. And it's from the Sunday show. You're generally in the Sunday show about 6 months or maybe a year. And from that, they get the new groundlings. So I was there almost a year and a half, 2 years, taking all these classes and getting higher and higher. Get in the Sunday show. Did one Sunday show. And I got Buddy Holly. And I moved to London.
So you moved to London to the stage show, Buddy Holly.
Yep.
So was there anyone that you were training with in the groundlings that ended up being a big deal? Because they put out a lot of famous people.
Yeah, I was actually right before a lot of them. I was sort of in between. Phil Hartman had been just a few years, and John Lovitz, right?
What geniuses.
You're right. Especially Phil. I mean, anybody at the Groundlings would say that he was utterly unique and born to be on that SNL stage because he could play all those characters. But all those things, so many of his earlier characters happened right there on the Groundlings stage. And he was actually a mentor towards... Julia Sweeney, who it's Pat. She was there too, and then right behind me was Will Ferrell. When I went off to London, Will came in right after and was in the Groundlings, and Will Ferrell and Chris Kattan and Sherry O'Terry. And
I mean, it really was a training ground for SNL.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's where they went to find.
Yeah, because it wasn't.
There were a few of them. There was one in Chicago. There was one in LA. There was one in New York, but that was really one of.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't do justice to the actual list. You would have to go look at it and you'd be blown away because it wasn't just improv at the Groundlings. Most of it was sketch work. You would, that's what actually brought me there. When I first went to LA, I mean, I so respect you doing stand up because I've tried it. I went out when I first went to LA and you can't just jump in a movie or jump in a TV show, but you can jump up on a stage with a microphone. They'll let you do that every Wednesday at certain places. So I remember going to the Comedy Store on Sunset Boulevard, wrote this horrible little 5 minutes. And I remember getting up, and I had a guitar, and I had a couple funny songs to sing. And I remember the first lesson I learned is you got to be talking immediately because I was silent, and I was setting up my mic, and my head was down, and getting everything ready. And I look up, and it's been dead silent for 30 seconds. And I was so scared. I can remember my knees knocking. My mouth was foamy. I was freaking out. And I did my horrible 5 minutes, and I got off, and I went into the bathroom, and this was one of the most pivotal things for me ever, was I went into that bathroom at the Comedy Store, and I looked into the mirror, and I was just so furious with myself. I was just furious because it was instantly clear to me that as I walked off the stage, even before I got off the stage, is this is what you want to do for a living. Not stand-up, perhaps, but standing in front of people and performing. You want to do this for the rest of your life, and you're going to let 200 strangers that you will never see again, half of whom are in the bag, you're going to let them petrify you like that? You're going to let them freak you out like that?
So how did that change you?
I went back a week later with the same middling material and did it again and wasn't even a little scared. It was so binary, an on-off switch, because I was way more afraid of me. And what it was a perception thing. I perceived the whole thing differently. I didn't perceive that I needed to be great right then. I perceived that I needed to not give a crap and not be afraid of them. I needed to be able to breathe on stage. So I just got up and I just stood there. And then I was able to do it a couple other times. And it quickly became clear to me that it wasn't my thing. I'm not that solitary a guy. I'm a more social person. And I like interacting. And also not knowing anybody, it was a really bad way to network. I wasn't meeting anybody. And a couple comics I met, I would feel like we'd be talking and have a conversation. And I was like, oh, this guy's cool. And he's funny, man. And then like an hour later, I go, that dude was trying out his whole act on me while we were talking. He'd get up there and say all those same bits that I've been
like. If you laugh during the conversation.
Yeah, and it made me like, oh, man.
I do that with my friends sometimes. They don't even know it. Like, I'll do stuff. They're like, oh, man, I'm dying. And they didn't laugh. All right, maybe I don't use that one. That's what we do. We have to find a training ground because here's the difference is that I can sit in my room. And for us, when we do the Raging Idiot, it's a whole different show. I can sit in my room, I can play guitar, and I can practice. I can practice chords and fingering and muscle memory. And you can't practice on stage. You have to get up and fail. And you have to be confident that you're going to fail and that it's okay, or you're never going to make
this it. This is why I'm so impressed with what you do, because I've often thought of, what if I went back now? I have points of view now. I have things I might like to say. I might be able to do that, but I know you got to suck for a while, or you got to be find your material. Even the best comics go into little clubs, and there's some now, some of the bigger ones, I think Chris Rock and the others, where everybody has to put their cell phone in a bag. Yeah. And because you know that all these comics, they got great with that.
You have to suck for a while.
It's the 10,000 hour rule. Yeah. They got great by being bad for 10,000 hours.
And you suck.
How do you do that?
You suck for a long time. But you suck and you get better and you get better until you hit it and then you record it, then you're done. You got to start sucking again.
Yeah.
That's the weird part about it all. Because I'm going to do a comedy special in March or April of next year. Like a special that we haven't announced yet. But it's like we've been building and getting better and getting better. And I know as soon as we do the special, all that material's dead. Because you've done it. It's not like a song where you can hear it 30 times
over.
Well,
you know, there's a real debate on that. It goes back and forth. There's a book I gotta give you. A fantastic book I just read. I guess I'm not going to remember.
Steve Martin would do this, some of the – because I'm a huge Steve Martin fan.
Yeah. Yep.
Like one of – Steve Martin did something remarkable in his career that I have seen no one do. And that is retire at the top of his game and not tell anybody.
Yep.
He was just the greatest and was like, I quit. He didn't tell anybody he quit. He just quit.
Yeah.
But people knew his jokes.
Well, that's the thing. This book I was reading, Judd Apatow's, since he was really young, wasn't just a stand-up, but he would interview all these stand-ups. So he has interviews with...
As kids, he would interview them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to remember this. It's Crazy in the Head or something like that. I'm getting the title wrong. In any event, there was a debate within there with people think... Jerry Seinfeld, I guess, is one of the few that says, you don't have to retire anything. People don't mind hearing that joke again if it's funny. But I'd be in your camp. I would feel like, oh, they've heard this one. That's the worst
thing. I start to feel like, oh, they already know where this is going. I need to get better. Maybe that's a personal thing with me. Like, no, I always feel like I got
to
get better.
Well, even if it is a personal thing, you can't fight it. But how do what is your thing like when you're on stage? When something wouldn't work, that's the thing I realized. When something wouldn't work in improv, we always get to go, what? I just made it up. Don't judge me. You know, it's not so easy, is it? And the other thing is, if I said something that wasn't funny, I got three other guys to go, really? That's what you're going to go with? And the audience would die laughing at how bad the thing I said was. So what do? Do you embrace the suck when it goes bad, or what do?
You know that it's the loneliest place in the world before you go out there. There's no one to lean on. There's nowhere to fall back. It's when you miss, and you do miss a lot. And I do. You have to miss. When you miss, it's awful. When you hit, it's the most amazing thing. So you really play for the amazingness.
But what goes through your head after a miss? How do you pick yourself?
It's like a quarterback throwing interception. You have to be the quarterback that throws the interception. You got to be Aaron Rodgers that throws three picks in a game and gets back up and continues. And if you don't have that mentality, it's just not for you, because you will throw a lot of interceptions.
Yeah, we know that's something that's very common with improv. Is I used to say that you have to rip out the rearview mirror. Because every second you're looking in that rearview mirror of that thing that you could have made funnier 20 seconds ago, you're going to go right into a brick wall. So you take that out and you move forward. But I'm even talking about that thing where you tell a joke and it gets sort of anyway, I never know how to do that. I never know the next thing.
You just move.
You just move. Duck and dodge.
And just go to the next thing. And there are jokes that I've worried about that I wonder. And I don't ever share my act, because I just wait for it. But there was one joke that I told in particular that I tried out. Because what happened was I had a weekend off, which is awful for me. I don't like to have weekends off. And so I was like, I know I'm going to go to theater down in Franklin, and I'll do two shows back to back. Because I wanted to work just new material. And so the problem was some of the critics and blogs and press wanted to cover it. And I was like, well, great. I can't just go work new material if people are going to come out and watch it. But I still had the two shows, and I wanted to throw some new stuff in. And I'd written this joke this day, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I should try it. And the joke was,
I'm nervous here sitting here for you. It's already happened, and it's not me, and palms are sweaty.
And I don't ever just sit after a joke and wait. Like, more of my stylists tell the joke, and I'm moving. I'm quick. Mm-hmm. I'm quick. And sometimes they miss, sometimes they don't. But the joke was, finding an Uber driver is like, I've been in an Uber and the guy would not stop talking. And I was like, finding a good Uber driver is like finding a good woman, because I've been single a long time. I'd led up into all this singleness joke.
They have apps for that too.
They do. I've tried them. And it's like finding a good Uber driver is like finding a good woman. They either talk all the time, they either don't stop talking, or they don't let you do butt stuff. And I just sat and I let the crowd go. Wait, I let the crowd go. Huh. And then they start. There's never a more vulnerable moment than when you say they either don't stop talking or they don't let you do butt stuff. Talking about an Uber driver, and it was a really hard spot for me just to sit and wait.
Well. That's fascinating, because so much of what you do on the radio, you don't get to learn the timing of an audience.
None. It's two different things.
So you wouldn't have a clue that...
Two different things.
But you were wise to know that required math. They had to do the math on, wait a second, he's talking about an Uber, and then they get...
And it's just so absurd.
Exactly. Well, let me ask you, I haven't seen the app.
Right.
They get there faster when the jokes are like that. My problem was some of my jokes would be one way, and then I would do the absurd one. And if they're not with Steve Martin, you knew the absurd one was coming. With Stephen Wright, you know the absurd one's coming, so they're faster to it. But if you're not dealing pitches like that, then it takes them a second longer to catch it. Is that a lot of them, or is that unusual?
No, very, very. That one is unlike any other. Yeah, I knew I had to sit and wait on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a very vulnerable feeling, sitting and waiting, because as I sit there and waited... I just waited, and if nobody laughs, you're isolated, and then you just go to the next joke. but they laughed.
Do you ever watch any Andy Kaufman?
That's YouTube? My hero. It's my hero. Andy Kaufman's my hero.
Yeah.
Like David Letterman's my real life hero of my lifetime. Mm-hmm. Like I was able to watch. Andy Kaufman to me is the most brilliant, I'm not even say comic, performer that I have ever seen.
I agree. I just went down that rabbit hole the other night on YouTube, was watching Jerry Lawler. There's a great Jerry Lawler interview about that whole thing they did, the wrestling thing that Andy did.
He would wrestle women. For those who don't know, Andy was the women's wrestling champion. No woman could beat him wrestling.
And he finally said to this Jerry Lawler, nobody would let him wrestle guys up north, but there's this guy down here, I think it was in Memphis, actually.
Yeah.
And Jerry Lawler said,
Mid-South wrestling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He said, I'll wrestle him. So they went down, and Jerry Lawler put two pile drivers on him.
Broke his neck, and he put on the...
And back in the day, when you were watching it live, you were honestly never... You thought it might be a put-on, but then you go, no, I think this is real. And that was the joy and the beauty of Andy. But what I'm relating it to is I would think, going back to that and watching him stand in front of an audience that hates him or isn't getting it, that would give me the... That would give me strength. To the next time I went on, I would choose to be braver. I would want to be able to stand there. I remember even one of my first auditions, I had an audition to play Prince Charming in some show at some big, big theater. This is in Los Angeles. I had not auditioned for anything, and I could feel those nerves creeping in again. And I knew I didn't want to do this job, and I probably wasn't going to get it. We had to audition in front of everybody. Everybody was all in the room when you auditioned and read before like the table, like in Fame, that long table where they all sit there. And they said they wanted you to read a piece, like a monologue. I didn't have a monologue. So I stood there and I said, I do not have a monologue today. So for my audition, I will be reading from the classic Louis L'Amour novel, Hondo.
It's like Kaufman and the Great Gatsby, dude.
It was. It was exactly that. And I knew that. I knew I wasn't being original. But I also knew it was going to take a tremendous amount of balls to just stand there and read until they stopped me. So I just opened it up, and it's dead silent. And you hear a little rustling. I go, Hondo walked into the noonday sun. And I just began, and they're just sitting there letting me read and read and read. And I was doing it on purpose for the Kaufman-esque reasons of...
Internal strength, man. I bet you were developing it as it went.
Yes. I'm the boss of this moment. And to prove it, I'm not gonna go for your approval at all. I'm gonna stand here and be disapproved by you and sit in that for a little bit.
Do you love Kaufman?
Yeah. I it's funny because it's the same way we both make sense. We love the British Office. It's uncomfortable.
So uncomfortable.
I don't know why I love that uncomfortable thing.
Because it's a risk. I think that's why I love it. It's a really risky thing to do.
It is. And also, you talk about his timing and his commitment. He was fully, fully invested. And I just, honestly, I don't regret much, but I do regret looking back that I didn't more fully commit to some of the comedy I was a part of. That's who the great ones are. That's your Chris Farleys and, you know.
It's always the darkest people that are the brightest shiners.
Well, that's true.
But which is weird for you because you are the happiest. Like me, I go into a hole. Chip, and I go into a hole until it's time to come out and do my thing. And I'm not super social. And I see you and people, and you talk to people, and you hug people. And I do until I don't. But you are always on, which is weird for me to see someone who can do all of this and still maintain like your creativity.
You know, I there was a time in my acting classes where I remember, I haven't had this easy upbringing. If I wrote a book... There would be things. There would be my parents' divorce and growing up without my dad right there. My dad and his second wife lost a son to crib death, and I was still a young guy. There's that stuff was brutal and hurts and still hurts. So that's all in there. But I remember even in acting, seeing these people with these stories, and going, man, I somehow wish my life was a little more messed up. I'd have more to draw on. But I stopped that. I grew out of that. I'm not, believe me, I got my dark places. I have my tough, my sad moments. I don't know if it's any less than a whole lot of people. I got to be honest, I feel very, very blessed, very, very fortunate. And I feel not a responsibility that I have to put a fake face on. But when somebody comes up, it requires so little from me. It requires so few calories. Fame or these TV things, it's almost like a long lever. Like if you're trying to get a rock out of your yard, right? And you have a little stick, it's not going to do it. But if you have this long, long 2x4, right? And you stick it under there and you got a good level, you barely got to pull at the end of it and it can move a big old boulder. I feel like that's what it is when I'm out there. All I got to do is say, well, it's nice to meet you. Thank you. Really? Oh, well, thank your mom for me. And you know, take a picture. It just doesn't feel like a lot to me. In fact, I don't know why psychically, emotionally, it feels like more energy to me to hold that off somehow, to give a stiff hand, to keep my head down, to avoid it feels like it would take a whole lot of effort.
For me, it's not avoidance because when I'm out, like I appreciate anyone that does anything that I do. It comes, listens, but I stay in my room until I want to go out. It seems like you're out and you're very social all the time.
No, I don't. I don't. I'm home. I'm home a whole lot. The things I go to, you do a ton of charity events. You go to things and you're out in the world probably more than I am. If we were really going to compare schedules, you're talking about when you're off the clock, you mean?
I just feel like I have two modes, hide in my room and then when I'm out. And when I'm out, I'm appreciative and I love everybody all the time. But I have a really where I just want to be by myself a lot.
Well, I think the family changes that, you know.
That's fair. And you do have a family. Yeah, I have a dog.
When you have whatever you have,
right.
you're going to go to your daughter's pageant. You know, you're going to go to your son's scout meeting, and there's going to be other fathers and there's going to be other people. And I'm not always super in my comfort zone in those moments, but I can't choose that other thing. And I really don't want to. Look, I've been doing this a long time. I'm just grateful. I don't know how long I have doing this. We saw how fragile it is. It almost went away right there. And when it's gone, I don't know how long people care about my singles or what I'm doing. I've had 20 years to sort of not be bothered.
So now it's like, please bring it up.
It's not even please. It's like, I don't mind. I mean, Whose Line was fine. I'd be in line. It would, nobody'd say anything for like a week, and then I'd be in line at the bank, and somebody would just tap my shoulder and go, you're very funny. And like, man, you can't pay for that. And so I think I just, I'm making hay while the sun shines, and I do enjoy it. I'm not going to lie. I love it.
Mike, how long are we into this?
A little over an hour.
Okay, well, we're about to wrap. This is the long... We could do this for 3 hours. Like, I really feel like we could sit here for 3 hours and just talk. I do want to say, the first time I saw you, I was a huge Married with Children fan. And when you came in as Kelly's boyfriend...
Lonnie Tott.
Yeah. That's the first time I ever saw Chip Astin on television.
There you go.
And you were Kelly Bundy's boyfriend. Were you a mechanic? What was your job?
You know what? I think I was. I was the heir to the Tot fortune. They actually made tater tots, and so I was the dumb son of a rich.
You're really
family.
Dumb. Yeah, oh, very you're really dumb. Dumb. Really good looking. Though.
I made Kelly look smart, which was the trick in that thing. By the way, I bet I was on something before that you knew. Do you remember? Were you a Cheers fan?
Oh yeah, I watched Cheers. Right? I was really young, but I remember Cheers. Yeah.
Do you ever remember an episode where? Look at me pitching my. We're almost done.
So you were an episode of Cheers?
I was. That was the very first thing I did, which was mind blowing because it was like through the looking glass. It was literally like looking at a painting, or it would be like looking at that dog's playing poker painting your whole life, right? And then one day you're sitting at the table with the dogs looking out. That made no sense, but do you know what I mean? Stepping to the other side of that was mind blowing. But it was a really fun episode where Cliff buys a video camera, and he gets into this idea that he and Norm are going to start filming people's events because so many events happen at the bar. They will start videotaping them on a big old VHS tape, and they will make some money while they're in the bar anyway. So let's videotape their events. The very first one they do, it's a giant family reunion. And they've got this thing on their shoulder, and these cool things are happening, and suddenly they realize that they don't have a battery. There's no battery, and he didn't get a battery. And so it's just a dead camera. And so they decide what they're going to do is Cliff says, oh, it's all right, Nami. We're just going to pretend that we're shooting this whole thing. And then later we tell them we lost the tape in the mail, that you know we sent the tape and it just won't arrive. So the whole episode is them pretending to tape. And he goes, what's going to happen anyway? It's just a family reunion. And of course, bigger and bigger things happen. And the grandfather stands up and goes, I've never told you all this, but I want you to know I love you. I love every one of you. And he's like, oh, it's not my fault he didn't tell his family he loved them. And then later I was like the second thing where I come busting in the door and dressed in full military garb. And I'm like, Grandma, Grandpa, I threw 30 hours on a Max
back
just to get here.
That's funny.
Just to say happy anniversary. I'm like, oh, Terry, we thought you were dead. And they're pretending to film it. And then the best one of all is the grandmother who's been in a wheelchair the entire episode says, I want you to all know that you've given me the strength to do this.
Oh, no. She steps up out of her wheelchair.
And they're going, oh, my God. So I guess you don't remember it, but if you saw it, that was the real first big thing that I did. It was their last season. It was a thrill. So, yeah.
So here's and back to today. So I searched Charles Esten, and this is called This Town Is Ours. It's out now. So in every single Friday, for how long are you putting these songs out? Like, do you have in your mind what you can do now?
I think that's number 9. And yeah, I got a bunch more. And each I like more than the next. So they're all very, very different. I'm going to aim at a year.
That's crazy. To even go 25 is crazy. To go 52, like, that's right. I
probably won't make it. But if I say 20, it's like, so what? You made 2 albums. You made a double album.
That's a lot. That's still a lot.
I know. Look, I love writing. I love doing it. And more than anything, if we've come down to one thing, unifying thread of all this, I don't mind failing. If I don't make it to a year, I didn't make it to a year. It's a nice round number. If there were 10 months in a year, I'd probably say that. But I know I have over 30. And for me, it's... It'll mean the music's out there. It'll mean I have a body of work. I'm 50 damn years old, and in 2 days I'm 51. What day is it? 3 days. Oh, you can cut that out if we're not on the right day. but what am I going to wait for? Am I going to put out an album, put out 12 songs, and wait another 8-10 months, put out another 12? Yeah, I could do that. I don't know. Is it going to? Am I going to knock Barbra Streisand off the charts? No. So I'm just putting out the songs, and already they're streaming, and already people are.
And they're getting put on playlists. Like, I mean,
it is.
You're doing a thing where I think people are starting to appreciate you as an artist, which is hard to do if you're coming from where people know you doing something else, which is your acting.
I think this takes that on immediately. That's right in the face. I mean, if I could do that for any amount, if it's nowhere near 52, and by the way, I wrote them all, or I co-wrote them all. That's saying something. I mean, so I got to be honest. I told you how old I am. I'm at the foot of a mountain again, and I'm looking up, and I'm just starting to climb, and that's thrilling. I'm not one of those guys that want to be, I've worked hard long enough, I'm done with it. I love this, and I love the fact that you and I sitting right here don't know what will come of this. We don't know what will come of it in a month or a year. If nothing comes of it, the music's all out of it. But meanwhile, you're walking around, every single song is a lottery ticket. I don't care. Somebody hears one, cuts it, and, you know, does an unbelievable version of it that I could never imagine. I don't even know what's going to happen. All I know is that I can only be in control of what I'm in control of, and that is making this music and sending it out there.
And Nashville starts back in November?
Actually, I believe they said the beginning of January, and I start back tomorrow. I shoot my first scene tomorrow.
January?
Yeah.
Why did I think November?
I don't know. Right. There was talk of December, but it wasn't my talk.
Well, that's also not November, so exactly. I missed it twice.
You just couldn't wait. You had to bring it in.
So January.
You were thinking of Thanksgiving and gratitude that
I have for you for sitting in a bedroom here at my house. Hey, do you have cushy chairs that rock?
This is cushy. This is the most comfortable interview I have ever been in. This sincerely, the fact that I'm still awake, this is so comfortable.
I appreciate you hanging for an hour and just talking. Like, this is my favorite thing to do. Like, just get down, learn, understand.
I like this podcast because it allows you to, what was the version you read? You get a different version of it. It's like slower. You can go down paths and alleyways that you normally wouldn't have time for or want to. I could take you on a boring anecdote or two that we would add to. Cut from. Sometimes it's just how stories are. So that's why I like listening to them too. You're going to get that next level. So thanks.
Nashville back in January. And that's awesome. We'll watch him. And the music's out there. Search Charles. That's his performer name.
And it's hashtag every single Friday. Let me say one more thing about Nashville. We didn't get too much
the show
about
or the city.
This will be about the show.
Okay.
I'm really, this is not like going to CMT and these new writers, this is not like a tacked on extra year to a show that by all rights is done.
I didn't know that. That's what it feels like it could be.
No, that's what it might have been and could have been. I totally get that. Honest to goodness, as much as I love the show, I wouldn't have wanted to do that. I don't want to tack on an added year beyond what it is. This is at the beginning, like I said, the beginning of a mountain again. This is a new thing. These writers have a new take on this show. But when I say a new take, it's almost the original take. Not, look, even this, all right, what we're doing right here is a more lyrically paced, and you can wander and meander and touch on some things that you couldn't well, I can't tell you what you can't do because you do whatever you want on your show. But I just generally mean in the format of radio,
no, sure.
A broadcast radio.
Absolutely.
Well, it's the exact same thing with network TV. There's things you have to do. There's masters you have to serve. You have to flip a truck or two. You have to, fall off a building or two. And these things that I'm real pleased for the 4 years we had and very grateful. But in this other setting, whether it's CMT and these new writers, I think that we can go back to some of the stuff that not only was initially drew people to the show, but I always think it was the real heart of the show anyway. We were sometimes competing in an arena that wasn't our strength. It wasn't our forte to compete with a show that can be so incredibly. There's so many things that go on some of these shows, on these network shows, and we were doing that too. But I thought the thing, and that's what makes them great. But that's never was what made us great. What made us great, and what attached people to us and made them not let go, was those tiny little moments, those little looks between Deacon and Rainer, that little sad moment between whether it was Juliet or something like that. It was those moments of connection and those more real moments. I think we're going to be able to get to do a lot more of those, and the whole thing is going to be able to breathe a little bit. It's like an old time lemonade, that lemonade stand that we first were for a little bit. We ended up having to make a lot more lemonade at a much bigger scale,
quicker pace.
Yeah. And even what I'm saying, I'm not disrespecting what we did, but I'm just saying that
the nature of the beast was that you had to do a network television show at a network television pace.
Yeah, and we loved getting to do it, and they were fantastic while we got to do it. But it's like, ooh, what are we going to get to do now?
Well, is there anything you want to say? Because we read that Connie only signed up for half the season.
I'm not allowed to comment on any of that because that leads to a storyline and all that. All I can do is comment backwards, and you know, I mean, how much she was, the day I met her, it's the worst line in the world, but it was truer than it could be. So I said, there's a million reasons I'm excited to do this show, and you're a couple hundred of them. I was a huge Friday Night Lights fan. She is going to be there tomorrow when I go to work, and she's been there every day until now. And
I could not ask. I could not bring that up.
No. I wouldn't. I would drive out here going.
I could not bring that up.
He didn't even ask. Yeah, yeah.
I have also become personal friends with Connie, and man, what a strong.
What's she like?
I don't even say strong woman because I don't want to disrespect women.
Right.
She's just one of the strongest people. And you have a conversation and you just kind of fall into it with her.
I completely agree. And I'll tell you what, more than that, throughout all these years of what we've been doing, one of the true norths of the show was Callie Curry. Whenever she would direct or whenever she would write an episode, I always could feel the whole thing come more back towards true north, like on your compass of what the show is best at, what it's meant to be. Connie is that as well. Connie would always have a clear vision of what this should be and what we were doing. And she was, for me, I give her so much credit for anything I've ever been able to do on the show because she's an absolute truth detector. Or maybe that's a nice way of saying a bullshit detector.
Big time. And with me too. Like, she's called me out on, she's passionate.
Yep.
And she's very much, here's what I am.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And also even in terms of her acting, it's just real. She's just talking. I remember, I think it was first season, but I realized that if you're talking to her in a scene And it's very hard not to add your little things that you think are going to make you look cool or make the line sound really good. And so you create this little primrose path that you might walk down for how the scene will play the best. But that's not being in the moment, and that's not being real. And I don't know how she's going to react to something I say. So how can I know how I'm going to react to her reaction? So it forced you to let all that go, because the second I didn't let it go, if I ever said something, her truthfulness would make me sound so damn phony that I'd go, let's try that again. Stop. I can't do it that way. And I would just – and so I remember one time, this was it in a nutshell, that we did. We were doing some scenes, and she did all her coverage, and it was my turn. And it was feeling good. It was fine. And finally, we had a great director too. And he walked back, and he's going to the back to the video village. And we're about to say action again. I just leaned over to her. I go, I just wasn't feeling it all the way. And I said, just give me something. Give me something. Give me a note. Say something. Make me be better. You know, real quickly. And she smiled. She goes, just talk to me. And I was like, oh, damn it. Yes, yes, exactly that. It's so obvious, but it's so brilliant. And so we did that take, and she says her thing, and I just talked to her, and it's like that again and again, that. But it takes somebody strong both mentally and, you know, emotionally and every other way to remember that and to hold to their guns and always be that.
It's back in January. Chip's got songs every Friday for the next 10 years. He's claimed it here. He's going to do this for 10 years.
I said, eventually, honestly,
it's going to be every single day.
What I said was it's every single Friday until it's stupid. And I don't know, it might already be, but until I think it's stupid.
I think, like I told you privately, was I think as an artist, you're showing something here that people didn't know you were. And so you're consistently putting out new music. You're showing that you are. Okay, yeah, you're Deacon on Nashville. You're this here, but you're also an artist, and you play live shows. And you know, for people to be able to see versatility is tough, because they start to put people in roles, and you're doing something that's kind of hard for people to understand at first. But I think people are finally getting it now.
I'll tell you one more thing. It's been so cool, because you've seen this, and now I've finally seen it. After all these years of playing here and around town and around the country, I've played shows now for the last couple of weeks, and as I'm singing a song I love, I see it on their lips.
Coolest thing ever.
It's the coolest.
It's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's nuts.
So already, I win. Ta-da.
Ta-da. All right, there he is, Chip Esten, or as he makes me call him off the microphone, Charles. Thank you for being here on the Bobbycast. Dude, I hope you had fun. This is a lot of fun for me.
It was a blast.
Just to sit back and talk it out.
Thank you, man.
Mike, you want to? We never went to you. We got lost. Anything you want to ask Chip before we go?
Just thanks for talking about Hoedown. That was my favorite bit ever. I was geeking out a bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Hashtag every single Friday again. Charles Esten. And he's got new music every Friday. And there's a lot out there already. And he's also on the road a lot, playing. You and Claire are playing. You and all.
Yeah, we're in New Jersey. I don't know when this airs, but
it'll be up tonight, but it'll be up forever. So
there you go.
He'll be in New Jersey soon, and then probably again.
Forever.
And then
yeah, exactly.
All right. Thank you, guys, and we'll talk to you soon.